Welcome back to part two of We Love Movies. Just before the break, I was telling you that Kathryn Bigelow's new film, Detroit, is out in cinemas this weekend. Now, for those that don't know, Kathryn Bigelow, Oscar-winning director behind the likes of The Hurt Locker. She also helmed Zero Dark Thirty. Detroit is her brand new movie, like those previous films, based on a true story. Joining me now to review the film is Rory Cashin. So, Rory, the film is set in 1967. The Detroit riots have started, and there's so much racial tension. It feels like it's at an all-time high in this period of time in the States. But the film doesn't really look so much at the overall view of the riots, but narrows its focus to the Algiers Motel. What happens?
Yes, a group of entertainers, like a Four Tops, kind of Four Singer dudes, are kind of evacuated from a nearby concert hall. This was their big break. They were about to get a big, massive break in their careers. But due to the riots happening outside, they had to be moved along. So they head along to the Algiers, and there's a little bit of a party going on there. And one of the party goers there happens to have a starter's pistol, like you would use to start a race.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just kind of playing around with it, and just fires it out the window. And local police officers believe that there's a sniper there. So they all kind of descend on the Algiers, and the few people who are left are kept in there and are kind of physically and psychologically tortured over the course of the night by police officers who are kind of fronted by Will Poulter, who is this really, really powerfully performed character who is so racist, but is so in denial about his own racism. It's like he doesn't even fully appreciate or realize his own level of hate towards anyone who isn't white. And he really just like plows down to find out who inside this hotel had the sniper's rifle. And even though we know there is none there, and the people who are stuck there with him know there's none there, he is not going to let anyone leave until he finds the gun and the person who was firing at them.
Okay, here's a little bit from the trailer to Detroit.
When I went in there, three kids had been killed.
No. So they were killed right before you got there. You carry a 38, right?
A revolver. You carry a revolver.
I do have a 38.
You ever shoot anyone?
I didn't do it. Police.
Oh, here we go.
Now, the film, the first act, is some might feel that it's a bit scrambled because you never really settle on the main characters, as it were, for too long. It's sort of bouncing around the place. It's really until we get into the second act where the story starts kind of finding its feet and getting into gear. How did that work with you?
Yeah, like, it was an odd follow-on. It's difficult to describe the film in those terms, because looking back on it, it makes sense, because it feels like they're really purposefully slowly building up to the siege scene, I guess you call it, in the hotel, because it really is letting you know where everyone is and who everyone is and why everyone is involved. And it does feel a bit scattershot. Mm. So then when they are all drawn together in the hotel, you kind of understand who everyone is. But even at that point, there was characters who I don't think were introduced until we got to the hotel. And until everything starts going to hell, like Anthony Mackie's character showed up really late.
He did, yeah.
Whereas some other characters who we spend a lot of time with don't get a huge payoff. So I feel there is another edit to this somewhere where some of those issues are maybe better dealt with. But yeah, like the first act did feel a bit kind of introductory.
It did, and I thought it was
only when it got to the hotel that you're like, ah, okay.
And also, right, it was one of those movies when it didn't even know how to end, it felt, because it was going on. You thought, okay, this should be the natural conclusion we're coming up to now, and maybe some text on the screen then to maybe jump forward a little bit just to give us an insight. But then it becomes a courtroom drama. And I thought, wow, am I about to watch a mini-series here in the cinema? That's what it felt like. It felt like a HBO.
I kind of understood the ending, to be honest. It was a very messy ending, And I feel that was a very good reflection of what had actually happened and is continuing to happen with the riots and with the racial issues in America. Like, there was no clean, happy ending. And it did just kind of continue on and peter out and just come back again every now and again. You think, is it done? No, it's not done. I guess it's still happening. Like, it's kind of a nice little reflection back to how it still is in America now. Like, you just have to look at the news and you see...
Oh, but it's a very timely film, without
oh my God,
doubt.
Like,
but the overall message of the film is what these cops did, the way they brutalized and victimized and assaulted these black men and two white girls in this motel, was absolutely despicable. It was complete nut thuggery what happened. But it just felt like that was the message. Like, what these guys did was bad. And I don't know, could they have delved a bit deeper into these guys, into their psyche, so that it didn't feel like the film was being played more for a wide audience? That it just felt, I don't know if you picked up on this, but for me, it felt very superficial.
I guess for me, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Get Out, where it took a kind of horrific situation and again used racism as the villain. And I think it was very, very interesting that, you know, it didn't go too deeply into any, especially the police officers, like where we see a few scenes of them early on. But I think for me anyway, it's because they resonated so strongly with police officers that we've heard about in the last few years in America. The ones who are just so willing to fire their weapons into people trying to run away from them and kill them without question, that we don't need too much characterization for Will Poulter, because that type of person is still very much in existence today. Like, it's like, look at what happened, you know, 50 years ago, and look at America now. Like, what has changed, really? I think that was, to me anyway, that feels like what the message was. It was like, yeah, in some ways, we feel like the world has dealt with this problem, but all you have to do is really just look at the news and go, well, now it's just as bad as it ever was.
Out of 10 for Detroit, Rory?
I would give it a 7.5. I feel it won't get the Oscar stuff that maybe they had hoped for. Except maybe John Boyega. I thought he was actually fantastic, and Will Poulter, but he's going to have a difficult time even walking down the road now because he's so evil in this.
Yeah, he really
is. So evil in this.
Yeah, he plays the real quintessential nasty piece of work in it. But yeah, look, it is a very well-made film. It really is. And you do feel, as the horror unfolds, like this helpless bystander as you're watching, which is also a huge credit to Catherine Bigelow's direction. Rory Cashin, until we do it all again next week, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, believe it or not, but Superbad is 10 years old. Andy McCarroll will be taking a look back at the comedy gem in just a minute. But first, here's a little bit from the trailer.
It's Carrie Hutchins.
Yeah, I heard she got breast reduction surgery.
What? It's like slapping God across the face.
She had back problems, man.
Meet Seth.
Do you have any bigger clothes, or do you only shop at Baby Gap?
Evan. And Fogel.
Gangsters, what's up, guys?
Three lifelong friends that are about to go their separate ways.
Tonight is our last party as high school people. You know when you hear a girl saying, like, oh, I was so gone last night, I shouldn't have slept with that guy. We could be that mistake.
Andy McCarroll now joins me to take a look back at Superbad, which is 10 years old. My God, I can't believe how quickly that time has flown. Andy, I have to say, I love and adore Superbad. When I first saw it in cinemas, I was like, this is fantastic. It was so well made, and it still holds up. I know it's only been 10 years, but it's still incredibly funny.
It really is. And I think the kind of the secret to that is that it had such a talented cast, like, in, you know, behind the camera and in front of the camera. And I think where it differentiates from something like, you know, like American Pie, you kind of say, was the last, you know, 18s comedy, teen comedy that really had the breakout hit. And I think the difference for me with this one is that the guys in this film, you can actually see being best friends, whereas in American Pie, like, these people wouldn't hang out with each other in real life. And I think, you know, Michael Cera, Jonah Hill, and Christopher Mintz appears to play as McLovin. They really seem like they're three people who, if you put them in a high school, they would be drawn to each other and they'd be friends with each other. And of course, outside of that, the film is absolutely hilarious. Like, the chemistry doesn't matter if the film isn't funny, but there's just so many great lines. Like, I've been talking about it with a couple of friends during the week and asking people for their favourite moments or their favourite scenes, and nobody kind of said the same scene, which is a sign of a great comedy when you've got, like, you know, five or six memorable classic scenes that people really love.
Well, here's a scene actually I want to play out. This is where Seth Rogen and Bill Hader, they play two cops in the movie. And remember there was the robbery in the convenience store, and they are talking to the sales assistant, and they're just trying to figure out the ethnicity of the perpetrator. This is absolute gold.
Whatever 5'10 is, he was 5'10.
Ethnically, I mean, did what... I mean, was he like us or...
A woman?
No.
Female?
No,
is that what
no,
you're
no,
asking?
I was saying, was he...
Like,
what?
African?
What?
Was
he African?
African.
No, he was American, and he was like you. He looked just like you.
He's Jewish.
Just Wait, like
okay.
you.
Okay, Jew. Hey. It's an odd crime for a Jew to
yeah,
commit.
Yeah, pretty docile.
Okay, so we have an African Jew wearing a hoodie.
No, you don't.
No.
No, that's not what I said. Is that what you heard me say? I said he looked like you. Do you look like an African Jew?
No, I look like a cop.
Yeah.
So, Andy, let us now look at some of the trivia surrounding the film, because this is a project that Seth Rogen and his writing partner, Evan Goldberg, they were hoping to make this film for a very long time.
Yeah, they started writing it when they were 13 years of age, which, you know, if you see some of the scenes that are in the film, they were pretty warped 13-year-olds. Like, I was 13 and they go still playing with Ghostbusters Firehouse. And even then, at that stage, they'd already written a script for a Star Wars spin-off. So they're the most kind of prestige or prodigious 13-year-olds that I've ever met anyway, which makes me feel really bad about myself that at 13 they've written two scripts and I haven't done anything with my life really. So thanks for that, Gordon.
Don't feel bad. Look what you're doing now. if that's any help to you. So it was loosely based on their time growing up in Vancouver in the 90s. And do you know what I love about it as well, Andy, is that one of my favourite films is Dazed and Confused. And I love those high school movies that are set over one crazy night and all the highs and lows that go with it, and essentially the new things that are going to develop in their life off the back of it. Talk to me a little bit more about the cast in this film, because we touched on just briefly the main three players, but also the supporting cast, like Emma Stone. Like, this, if I'm right in thinking, was her first proper film role.
It was. This is actually her film debut, came in this as well. And then you have people like Jonah Hill, who appeared briefly in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. He's the guy buying the goldfish boot in the shop. He like has broken out. He's like Academy Award nominated now. Michael Cera has gone on to headline a number of films. Seth Rogen, this was the first film he'd written that was produced. Evan Goldberg. And they've kind of created their own little cinematic universe. You know, the likes of Knocked Up and 40-Year-Old Virgin, the Jump Street films, all kind of coming out the back of this one. And like you said, there was a great comparison there with Dazed and Confused. You'd like Ben Affleck, Matthew McConaughey, and Mila Jovovich. It was her first film. So the kind of the comparisons are quite unique. Things, again, we've touched upon American Pie. No one really broke out of that, with the exception of kind of Sean William Scott. No one made a big, successful career out of this. But you go through the cast of Superbad, like even as you said, the two cops, Bill Hader is a big star. He was in things like Trainwreck. He's a Saturday Night Live regular. Pretty much everyone in this film, you know, made a career for themselves just off the back of this. And it's strange to see a film with so many talented people in it, just, you know, at their coming out party, essentially.
And it was at a time when, in the States, R-rated comedy was back in vogue. You did feel the tide was turning. There was a real appetite for that raunchy, vulgar humour, but with heart and with great characters. And Judd Apatow, who produced Superbad, he was absolutely paramount for all of that. I just want to bring a talk about another cast member who will forever be known as McLovin, Christopher Mintz-Plasse. He was one of the youngest cast members in Superbad, which didn't go down the best in terms of one particular scene in which he had to film, because it meant a certain somebody had to be on set, Andy.
Yeah, during his sex scene, because he was under 18 and considered a minor, he had to have his parents there with him. So while he's acting out a sex scene, he has to have his mother standing 5 feet away from kind of monitoring what he's allowed and not allowed to do, which I'd imagine would kill the atmosphere and, you know, your kind of notions of being a movie star quite quickly if you have your mother beside you going, no, he's not allowed to do that. No, he's not allowed to do that. So, you know, as embarrassing situations go, it's up there.
Big time. Well, Superbad, it is 10 years old. One of the things I have to give everyone great credit for in this film is that they didn't succumb to a sequel, because over the years they were asked time and time again to make a sequel and they didn't. Do you think it warrants a sequel though, Andy?
No, and I really think like that's something that they could be really proud that they didn't. I think why this film resonates so much with people is everyone can relate to being in school, and then you have, you know, the group of friends that you spend 8 hours a day with, you know, 5 days a week for 6 years, and all of a sudden you don't see them again. And that kind of, you know, those the awkward conversations that Jonah Hill and Michael Cera are having when they, you know, the friendship is shifting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's things when you're not really mature enough to deal with at the time. And I think if you had a sequel, you know, you see them in college or you see them keeping in touch, it really wouldn't have had the emotional impact that this had. I think this is why it kind of stood out with all those 18s gross-out comedies. There's a real heart and, like, a decent friendship at the heart of the film that a lot of people can relate to.
Very well said. Andy McCarroll, as always, thank you so much for joining us on We Love Movies. And that is it for this week. We'll be back next Sunday with all the big cinema releases, and we'll also be going through all the big movie stories as well. For me, Gordon Hayden, enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and we'll chat to you next week.